Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to the best of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Today's program, we're going to be taking a listen to an interview that we did with Bob Zanotti, who was with Swiss Radio International, who did various news reporting, but is more well known for the Swiss shortwave merry-go-round that he hosted with Bob Thoman for many years. This program was originally broadcast September the 3rd, 2011.
Hi, this is Bob Zanotti. Do you miss Swiss Radio International? If so, I invite you to visit my website, SwitzerlandInSound.com. Colorful and informative radio features about Switzerland, its destinations, interesting people, politics, culture, and even the two Bobs, SwitzerlandInSound.com, where English language radio from Switzerland lives on.
Well, for those who may be too young to remember, that was the Swiss Radio International interval signal, which vanished from the shortwave bands when SRI became Swiss Info, a text-based news and information service about Switzerland. The board of directors of the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation, Swiss Info's parent company, accepted on the 28th of June a new strategic plan for Swiss Info. The online service will now focus mainly on readers abroad interested in Switzerland, as well as the Swiss abroad. Swiss Info will offer background information on Swiss politics, economy, culture, and social affairs in 10 languages, including Russian in 2013. Editorial processes will be reorganized. The yearly cost for the news mandate abroad will be cut by 9 million Swiss francs. With the reorganization, Swiss Info will lose 40 jobs of its 126 full-time positions. Around two-thirds of the losses will be accounted for by early retirements and transfers to other SBC units. For the remainder, redundancies will be necessary and a social plan will be implemented. Swiss Info will remain as a SBC unit in Bern. The annual savings will be shared between the SBC and the federal government. Joining us now on the line is Bob Zanotti, Media Network Plus's media commentator, for a closer look at the cuts and the switch from radio to text. Swiss Info was set up after Swiss Radio International went off the air. What was the reason for setting up the service?
Well, it was technically a transitionary measure. I'll try to be concise about this, but the story is rather contorted and rather complicated. Let's start with the old traditional shortwave service, Swiss Radio International. Everybody knows about that. Well, basically, in the late 90s, they had the notion that the internet was up and coming and we should have a presence. We, Swiss Radio International, should have a presence on the internet as well. And at the time, Swiss Radio International was still broadcasting on shortwave. And the early thinking was that the internet platform hadn't been named at the time, what is now Swiss Info, would be a supplement basically to the shortwave. And then slowly but surely, to cut to the chase here and to cut a long story short, it was decided that shortwave was just too expensive. The listenership was going down. We've been through this before, Keith. We know the story, and it's repeated itself over and over, yada, yada, yada. And so in any case, what was Swiss Radio International slowly but surely decided to put all of its eggs in the internet basket, and what was technically called in the transitionary period SRI Swiss Info in 2004, Swiss Radio International ceased all shortwave broadcasting, and the only thing left was the Swiss Info internet platform.
did anybody raise alarm with this? Because something that I was told by a listener that you probably know, Victor Gunatelica, he said me that when an international broadcaster goes to the internet, why would he listen on the internet? Because on the internet, he listens to so many other things.
Well, that's a good point. And I don't know whether to say that in the specific case of SRI Swiss Info, we were sold a bill of goods, but it seems so. In hindsight, I can remember discussions with the pro-internet people, as I say, assuring us that we could continue doing radio. This was just the new way to do it, the new medium. Well, the history speaks for itself. And frankly, and this is my personal value judgment, the audio that's on Swiss Info, frankly, I wouldn't want to listen to. It's not very interesting. So we're stuck with a text-based website only. What happened? I think what happened is what happened to me. I was the generation of broadcasters at Swiss Radio International who were broadcasters. We were professional, experienced radio people. We made and did radio programs. Well, as the Swiss Info transition came, it was decided by somebody up there somewhere, upstairs, that people like us were redundant, costing them a lot of money, and probably even at that time they knew that the services of radio people would not be necessary after 2004. So they got rid of us, basically. That's what happened to me back in 2001. And euphemistically, we were early retired. So what this amounted to was that the only people left, by and large, were new people who came in with no broadcasting experience, very largely, to a large extent, beginners, people looking to enhance their CVs by a stint at Swiss Info in Bern, and no background whatsoever in broadcasting. So it's not... in a way, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you get rid of all the broadcasters, what's left? Text journalists, and that's what we have today.
Now, Swiss Info has had a substantial cut made. Is this just, say, the calm before the storm? Is there a plan in the future to completely do away with Swiss Info?
That's entirely possible. Whether there's a plan, whether it will simply happen, I don't know, but I think you might be onto something there, Keith. I can tell you this, that the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation had its axes ready for Swiss Radio International and Swiss Info ready a long time ago. And it was only through the intervention, largely, of the Secretariat for the Swiss Abroad and some lobbying with Swiss parliamentarians that Swiss Info was rescued at all. Insiders I know, and from what I've been hearing locally here, speculated and reported quite clearly that they expected Swiss Info could possibly be axed entirely in the last review by the Swiss federal government, which is trying to save money everywhere. And there was an initial suggestion by the Swiss government that it end all financing for Swiss Info. That didn't get through thanks to parliamentarians intervening. Now, how long this state of affairs will continue, I don't know. It's entirely possible that this is an intermediate or transitionary phase, that slowly but surely the service may eventually wind down and be eliminated. But for the time being, at least for the next couple of years, the service will be maintained. I understand that there will be a consolidation of national language services with other Swiss Broadcasting Corporation internet platforms. This is logical because they have a common and parallel effort. This country speaks German, French, Italian, and Romansh. So why, one might ask, should there be a duplication or parallel service for all of these national services when the national networks already have them? So I would say the future of the national languages is quite uncertain here. My own guess is that key world and politically important or sensitive languages like English, Arabic, Chinese, Japanese, I'm not sure. Certainly Spanish, and now Russian, will probably eventually become the core effort. But how long that will stay afloat, I can't say at this point.
What was the difference in budget, let's say, between Swiss Radio International and Swiss Info? Was it substantial?
Well, it was essentially the same, and I can't tell you with authority exactly what the budget is right now. I saw the figure recently. Honestly, Keith, I forget what it was, and I don't want to give you wrong information. And with the rate of exchange at the moment, it's foolhardy to try to give an impression expressed in dollars or something, because the franc is up and down. Actually, it's up right now, so it doesn't mean too much. Basically, the original Swiss Radio International budget was transferred more or less one-to-one to the Swiss Info operation. Now, we have to be careful here. I'm talking about the operating budget paying for the journalists and the editorial infrastructure. Years ago, when Swiss Radio International was operating, the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation also had to pay for transmitter time, which it doesn't have to do now. I think this is one of the reasons why the cut in the budget of 33% is probably not that disastrous, because a lot of the money used to be used for broadcast facilities, which no longer are necessary. As we know, the internet is pretty cheap to operate. The editorial infrastructure does cost money. This is an expensive country. Salaries are good. And that's basically where the money is going. But, you know, here, from a professional point of view, we have a discussion which presents itself, and that is what Swiss Info is actually doing. Now, in my day, I remember when I started at SRI, which was the SBC, European and Overseas Services, back in the 1970 when I started, our operating budget, our annual operating budget for the whole shooting match was, I believe, 7 million francs, 8 million francs, which covered all of our expenses, journalists, production, transmitters, everything else, to my knowledge. And now, I mean, then it went up to 18 million. And now I believe, and please, I hate as a journalist to give wrong information, I have a figure of something like 28 million francs in my mind. But the question is, what are they doing for it? And here I get a bit bitter as an SRI veteran. In my day, you know, we got out there, we were in cars, we were going all over the country. Every day somebody was on the road reporting live from somewhere, doing reports, reportages, interviews, and bringing it back and getting it on the air. We were a radio station operating 24 hours a day. And now I get a bit bitter. I get very bitter, as a matter of fact, and so do my contemporary colleagues of my day, when we look at Swiss Info today and realize that basically all they are is a translating agency. They sit there in their ivory tower on Giacomettistrasse 1 in Bern. They don't go anywhere. They just sit and translate other people's work. And they're more or less just a text agency. And personally, and I have to be careful here. I know things have become more expensive over the years. You know, I'm not senile. I know that things have changed. But really, I won't say they're not getting value for money. I think it is justified to pose the question, are we getting value for money for what we're doing? That's an open question.
Bob Zanotti, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Oh, always a pleasure, Keith.
And that was an interview I did with Bob Zanotti in 2011. You're listening to the best of Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, every now and again, we like to bring stories on the program, including new ones, on a very wide variety of topics. One actually that is quite well-liked by many of you is, what is it like to work as a correspondent in a foreign country? Another one connected with that idea is, what is it like working as a foreign correspondent in the 70s and 80s, when things were very different? Well, next, Bill Bertels speaks to Richard Tharwaites, who is the ABC correspondent in Peking in the 1970s and early 1980s.
It was 2001, and I was in the throes of my first proper high school relationship. Back then, China was out of sight, out of mind for me, and when my then-girlfriend told me her dad was a Mandarin-speaking former ABC China correspondent, I didn't pay too much attention. Sure, it sounded interesting, but at the time I was more keen on playing guitar, finishing the high school certificate, and finding out where the next house party was. How things change. A few years later, I'd abandoned my musical ambitions, had developed a taste for journalism, and had become curious about the Middle Kingdom. And when I was posted to China in 2015, it was Richard Thwaites's picture among the former correspondents on the wall that made me regret not having picked his brain about China when I had the chance. So I decided to give him a ring. Richard Thwaites, the last time I spoke to you, I was probably 17 or 18 years old. So I've always wanted to ask, what was Beijing like when you first arrived here in 1978?
Well, the city itself was still recovering from an earthquake. So when you looked out the windows along Chang'an Dajie, the main road there, the centre of the road was full of temporary mud huts from all the people who'd fled out of the threatened apartment blocks, brick apartment blocks that then lined the street. Across the road was a Jeep factory. I don't know if that's still there. Probably not. But the climate was extremely tense. Politically, this was the Gang of Four period, just towards the end of it, when the people who were on the coattails of Mao Zedong in his last dying years, particularly his wife Jiang Qing, had taken over with and were trying to enforce a very puritanical and irrational form of communism onto the people. So everything was very tense. What journalists could do was extremely limited.
And where did you live? What was your accommodation like at the time? And when you went out, could you freely walk around the streets, or were you followed all the time?
You could. We weren't restricted in our personal movements within Beijing. We had to get permission if ever we wanted to leave Beijing, and we had to be accompanied by an official, and that always took a bit of palaver. But it did mean that when we did get out, it was a big deal, because we were quite often the first people to get to a place, say Tibet or some other remote part of the country where no foreigners had been allowed to go there for several years. So it was worth it, but it was just novelties. There wasn't very much you could do once you got there other than observe what was around you. But in Beijing itself, I could get on a bike and ride around, as I often did on a Sunday, for example, when I'd done my main filing for the weekly programs, like Correspondence Report. I'd then get off on a bike and I could ride around anywhere, up and down any little lane and whatever. So there was that degree of freedom, but if you tried to talk to people, that's when the shutters would come down. Not because they didn't want to talk to us, but because it was very dangerous for a local person to be seen talking to a foreigner, particularly a journalist, whose journalists were assumed to be spies or enemies of the people.
Well, since returning to Australia in the mid-80s, I imagine you've kept your eye on the way that China's transformed. What are your thoughts on China now compared to when you were there?
Well, it's not very different from what I at that time thought it was likely to be. There's been much more difference in the practice of journalism than there has been in the conduct of the Chinese government. I mean, for example, for me, getting any kind of film report out was almost inconceivable, because it would have to be, you know, a physical optical film sent out undeveloped to be developed and edited outside of the country, and you might get a film out three times a year, certainly not when as a routine matter like you can now with internet traffic and so forth.
Just finally, I imagine you've been watching the recent debate about Beijing's influence in Australia and all the reporting that's gone around that. What do you make of the journalism that comes out of China these days?
it's difficult to generalise because there are some excellent and perceptive reporters, and I don't want to make you blush, but I think you're among them. And there have been people in the past few years, there's always been some who've been very good, and there are others who just haven't really got it or have thought that they needed to play the short-term game in some way. But the only thing to be absolutely certain of is that when it comes to Chinese policy and strategy, the short-term game is never really what it's about. It's always about where they're going to be in 5, 10, 20 years. That's the way to interpret everything that happens now, from the carry-on with North Korea to the South China Sea to the ultimate goal of getting Taiwan back for the least possible cost.
Richard Thwaites, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat. Thank you so much.
Okay, Bill. Anytime you want to chat, I'm always happy.
And finally, G5 mobile networks are going to be starting to roll out over the next 2 years. There's a lot of concern about companies that are operating in, from China, for example, ZTE and Huawei, because they have direct connections to the Chinese government, and there's a lot of concern over security issues. Well, the Chinese telecom equipment Huawei says it is still committed to doing business in a country like Australia, which is, well, going to be making it a little bit more difficult for them. David Swan, who's a technology reporter for The Australian, speaks next to Patricia Cavaris.
So it's a whole new network, really, in the same way that the 4G network was new when that came out a few years ago, and the 3G and 2G networks before that. The preparations are underway to start building that infrastructure out probably around 2020 is when we'll first start really seeing it. And that'll be things from your new iPhone, but also more industrial uses like farming equipment and water supply and utilities. So really everything that'll be connected will have 5G connected to it.
Okay, so high-risk vendors will be ruled out as suppliers. That's companies likely to receive extrajudicial directions from a foreign government. Who does that cover?
In this case, they've cleverly worded it, but they're actually being very specific, really, about Huawei and ZTE, and those companies have confirmed that the government separately has contacted them each directly to let them know that they're implicated by this ruling.
So just Huawei and ZTE then, right? What about companies like Ericsson and Nokia, who have some of their equipment manufactured in China?
Yeah, that's the thing. So that's a big question mark, really, because some of their equipment is, like you said, manufactured in China. The crux of it here is really there was a law passed in China last year that says that their telecommunications companies are obligated to effectively help the government when asked, and that law applies to Huawei and ZTE. It's not clear, though, if companies like Ericsson would be impacted, but I don't think so.
And Huawei chairman John Lord was on RN Breakfast this morning defending Huawei. Here's what he had to say.
The situation is, more and more in the future, technology innovation is going to come from non-traditional sources. That is, not from the UK, US, more is going to come from Asia. Australia needs a framework to accept that technology innovation for the advantage of Australians within our national interests. This was an opportunity to start doing that. I think we still need to do it in the future because there's going to be more of these situations.
Huawei Australia Chairman John Lord there. Does he have a point? Do we need to be thinking about where our future technology is going to come from?
Yeah, I think he's got a very valid point, to be honest. And the thing is that Huawei said throughout this whole process, they're happy to do whatever it takes, really, to be able to still be involved. They're happy to be regulated. They're happy to go through extra checks and balances to make sure that everything's above board. And the reality is that we are getting our tech now from a more diverse range of places. And so, yeah, very valid point.
And he said that one in two Australians use Huawei in some way. And a new report out today actually shows that Huawei has passed Apple to become the number two seller of smartphones globally for the first time. So does it even matter if they're not involved in the 5G rollout?
Yeah, it's pretty lucrative for Huawei to have an opportunity here. I mean, if they could get involved, not everyone uses Huawei handsets, obviously. More people do use iPhones, but it's the things you can't see. It's the network towers. It's everything that kind of connects all the devices, the stuff that you wouldn't even know you're using is Huawei, but still has Huawei technology built in.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of the Best of Media Network Plus. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program or have any comments or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.